Anatomy and Physiology, The Reproductive Systems and Development, Part 2. Today we're going to talk about the female reproductive system. This is just the overview slide. Off to your left is a mid-sagittal section showing you some of the organs we'll talk about. And off to your right is just the list. So don't get nervous on this slide. We're going to look at those various pieces and parts one at a time in that order. Let's go ahead and start with the ovaries. The ovaries, of course, are the female gonads. The gonads are where the seeds and where the hormones are made. That's the big picture. Your book says the ovaries are roughly the size and shape of an almond, and I'm tracing over the two ovaries here. That's a fair enough description. I've seen them in real life, and I guess that's good enough. They are found in the upper pelvic region, and you can see from the back view of the drawing of this woman their approximate location as well. But what if we slice open an ovary and do a little bit of histology? Let's take a look, and this should overlap very well with lab. And it really is anatomy 101, guys. Once again, we have a connective tissue capsule made of collagen. And just like on the testicle, it has the same name. It's called the tunica albuginea, which just means a white coat. Deep to the capsule, we have the outer meat of this organ and almost every other organ in anatomy. It's called the cortex. And what is characteristic of an ovary? One of the ways you can tell you're looking at an ovary under the microscope is in the cortex, there are a series of roughly roundish structures of varying size, and those structures are called follicles with a star. Remember, a follicle just means a little bag or a little sac. In this case, ovarian follicles consist of cells called oocytes. That's just the name for egg cells. And those egg cells are in various stages of their development that we'll discuss. And the follicles also consist of the cells that surround those developing eggs. And the way I think of it is kind of simple. The eggs start out as kind of little baby eggs, and they grow up to be bigger and bigger eggs. And then the home of cells that surrounds them gets bigger and bigger as well. It's kind of like a hermit crab. Starts out small in a small shell, and then as it gets a bigger shell around it. And that's just the way I think of it. The next layer is the innermost meat of this organ. Of course, you know that's called the medulla by now. Has the same old junk in it. Connective tissue, nerves, blood vessels, lymph vessels. And then this organ, like many other organs in anatomy, has a little dimple in it where things can get in and out like blood vessels. And that is called the hilum. Let's look more specifically at the stages of follicular development. Again, follicular development accompanies oocyte or egg cell development. As the follicle goes from small to big, the egg is going from small to big. And we have a name for the follicle and a name for the developing egg. And the good news is for you and for my simple pea brain, it kind of goes in order if anybody asks you. The four stages of follicular development are, it starts with a small follicle called a primordial follicle. That's easy for me to remember because it kind of sounds like primeval. And then it develops into a primary follicle, followed by a secondary follicle, and then the most mature, most well-developed, biggest follicle of them all, somebody called the mature follicle. The mature follicle has a synonym that a lot of people in the real world use, so get used to it. It's also called the graafian follicle. So those are the four stages. That's easy to remember. It just goes in order. Now, in a woman's cycle, which we'll discuss in great detail, after ovulation, the mature follicle sort of turns into a brand new structure. Again, it's like going from a caterpillar into a butterfly. And the next structure that's formed after ovulation that I want you to know anyway for my course is called the corpus luteum. Corpus just means a body. Luteum means yellow, and it really is a bright yellow nugget that's visible inside the ovary. If you do an internet search on a corpus luteum, it really is a big, bright, obvious structure on a cross section in a woman's ovary. What you should really think of is this. The corpus luteum is a big, puffed up, pumped up bag of progesterone producing cells. For what? To prepare the way for the baby. Because after all, this is the reproductive system. The point is to reproduce. We just ovulated. We're going to try to make a baby. That's the whole point. And again, I make myself a little pee tongue twister here. The corpus luteum is a puffed up, pumped up bag of progesterone producing cells that prepares the way for the baby. It prepares the uterus and it prepares the breast. What if there is no baby? After about 2 weeks or so, the corpus luteum essentially dies. It shrivels up into a small white ball of essentially scar tissue, and it's called a corpus albicans. It just means a little tiny white nugget, and they look like little white dots on a woman's ovary. If you ever cross-section one in the operating room, almost looks like, you know, measles on the ovary or chicken pox, but they're just little white dots inside the cortex of the ovary. And those are all the little scars left behind after each time the woman ovulated. One other thing I want to talk about on this slide, we tend to leave this out, and that's okay. We can't cover everything in anatomy. There's this stage right here you might be looking at when I was talking about ovulation. There's another structure called the corpus hemorrhagicum. And when ovulation happens, it really is a traumatic event. I talked to a family member of mine who's an OBGYN doctor, and he explained in great detail how ovulation happened, and I never really fully understood it until he went over it with me. And it kind of goes like this. In the middle of a woman's cycle, which we'll study in detail, there's a hormonal surge that leads to the dilation of and swelling of the mature follicle. Essentially, the follicle fills with a whole bunch of fluid. It's essentially water, and it fills with more and more and more water. It's like pumping up a water balloon. And if you pump up a water balloon too much, what's going to happen? Under pressure, it's going to burst. So ovulation is really sort of a mini traumatic event. It's a bursting, like little water balloons popping once a month. And if you pop something like that, you could certainly rupture capillaries and cause a little bit of bleeding seen here on this slide. And that bursting also can be painful. So it's not unusual to hear of a woman noticing a little speck of blood during ovulation. And also some women can tell when they ovulate. They feel a little pinch of pain. And that pain has even been given a name. You can look it up in your book. It's called middle schmerz pain. So sort of fascinating how ovulation happens to me. Here's a picture showing a cross-section of a real woman's ovary showing the ovarian follicles in the cortex in different stages of development. And then off to your right, here's a real life picture that's just off the hook. I mean, this is ovulation caught in action. And you can see the cell being ovulated that we will learn is really called a secondary oocyte. And that egg cell, again, is bursting out of the cortex of the ovary, has to punch through the tunica albuginea. So again, you can kind of envision how this is a mini bursting traumatic type of event, if you will. This picture on this slide is a histological preparation, mostly meant to help you for the lab. It's a picture I'm calling a mature follicle. For lab, you have to know the pieces, parts of a mature follicle. the cell, the developing egg cell that's in a mature follicle, you must know is a secondary oocyte. The secondary oocyte is surrounded by a rim of cells that sort of crowns this big mommy cell. It radiates around it, and that's how it got its name, corona radiata. Then there is a big fluid-filled chamber in the mature follicle. That's called an antrum. Antrum just means a cavity or a chamber in anatomy. And then around the follicle, we can just generically call these follicular cells. So that will help you in lab more so than in lecture. Just like we discussed the process of spermatogenesis, let's discuss the process of oogenesis. Please let your root words help you. Genesis just means to make or create, and OO means egg. So this is the process of creating eggs. And again, conveniently for my pea brain, it just goes in order. So if you see a question, like put it in the right order kind of deal, it's easy. We start with a cell called an oogonium. That's the stem cell, just like the spermatogonium was a stem cell. The next cell produced is a primary oocyte, followed by a secondary oocyte, and finally we lead to an ovum, and the ovum is actually the mature egg. I'm going to cut to the chase here, not going to ask you to know all the nitty-gritty details, but here are the key bullet points you must know. Ovum development is similar to spermatogenesis, except egg development begins before birth. That's right. It begins in the womb. And number two, there is no continuing line of stem cells kept in reserve. So a woman is born with a maximum number of developing egg cells. Then it just decreases over time. As a matter of fact, your book says, while a woman is in the womb, she has approximately 4 million potential egg cells. At birth, that number is already down to 400,000 potential egg cells. At puberty, that number is down to approximately 40,000 potential egg cells. And during the course of an average woman's lifetime, she will only ovulate about 400 eggs. So it just sort of all withers on the vine, so to speak. The last big difference is one stem cell, one oogonium, gives rise to only one ovum. Here's a slide going into detail of oogenesis. It shows you meiosis 1 and meiosis 2, the reproductive cell division we already discussed in detail. If you want to look at this, you're welcome to it. I will show you what I want you to know, the key points to forever remember for my course. This is a great slide. Off to your left, this says with a green box, oogenesis, and it shows you the cell names we already discussed in order. Oogonium, primary oocyte, secondary oocyte, and then finally a mature ovum. Over to your right, it tells you what the name of the follicle is called as the egg is growing up. We start with a primordial follicle, followed by a primary follicle, then a secondary follicle, then a mature or Graafian follicle. What are the key new take-home points on this slide? You must know the name of the developing egg cell that is inside a mature follicle is called a secondary oocyte. So if you're following the story here, the other key point is, what does a woman ovulate once a month about in the middle of her cycle? She ovulates a secondary oocyte. We do not ovulate an ovum. We do not ovulate a mature egg. I know they told you that in eighth grade health class, but once again, they messed you up in high school. We do not ovulate mature eggs or ovums. We ovulate a cell called a secondary oocyte with a star on it. Now, we're finally ready to make a baby because we made a sperm cell earlier, and now we're making an egg cell. So let's discuss the process of fertilization. Fertilization is a process. It's not just one point in time. Again, I know in high school they probably messed you up and told you it was this single event. It is not. I like to describe it as a three-step process that you should be able to describe if you're asked. First step is the sperm cell, which is the male gamete, penetrates the female gamete, which you know now is really called a secondary oocyte. So that's step one. Once again here, I like Greek root words. Gamete, I don't think I ever told you, gamete in Greek actually means spouses, and that's kind of cool. So the first step is the spouses get together. What's the second step? The second step is completion of meiosis II by the secondary oocyte to form an ovum. That's right, an ovum, a true mature egg, is not formed until after the sperm penetrates the secondary oocyte. Then and only then will meiosis II complete and we will finally form an ovum. That's kind of cool to think about. The third step in the process of fertilization is we have the union of the nuclei of the gametes and we finally form our diploid structure called a zygote. That is fertilization. On this next slide, this is mostly just for you. This is just some cool scanning electron micrographs off to your left. Also a really cool light micrograph off to your right. Again, these things are just a bomb. Or they're sick, as my son would say. On your left, it's showing a blue sperm cell in contact with the red secondary oocyte. Kind of get the 3D effect here. And then over to your right, it's showing the nuclei of the male and the female getting together. Just awesome preparations here. Let me ask you something. Who knows the difference as far as development between identical and non-identical twins? How many eggs and how many sperm are involved? In an identical twin, it's one sperm cell getting together with one secondary oocyte. What about non-identical twins? It's two sperm and two egg cells. My next question for you is, why don't we have something called polyspermy? That is, why don't we have multiple sperm penetrating and getting inside this egg cell, which, by the way, would result in a non-viable fetus? Here's what happened. It's really cool. The first thing that happens goes back to something you may have already learned in neurophysiology. Something called depolarization takes place. In layman's terms, it's sort of like an electrical fence is set up. An immediate electrical fence block is set up. So once the first sperm gets through, no more sperm can get through. The second thing that happens that's a little bit slower to occur is a physical block occurs. It's sort of a hardening of the shell of the egg, if you will. So the electrical fence, the hardening of the eggshell, prevent multiple sperm from getting inside the egg. That's cool stuff. We do have to do a little bit of development. If you check the syllabus, you know that the chapter on development is part of this unit. I'm going to boil it down to the things you should know forever that I want you to take home. Starting with this slide. We made a zygote. That was what we made at the end of fertilization. Well, that cell starts to undergo division, and I want you to know after about day 4, we form this mound of cells, this solid ball of cells called a morula. A morula is a mound of solid cells. And in Greek, morula means mulberry, and I guess it looks like a mulberry if you know what a mulberry looks like. The next day, about day 5, we form a structure called a blastocyst. Why do they call it a blastocyst? Because if you cut that thing open now and cross-section it, it has a cystic cavity. Furthermore, the blastocyst is going to be the thing that really starts to build the baby. You need to know for my course, the blastocyst has two major parts. Number one, I'm tracing it now and it's got a green star on it. That is called the inner cell mass. And if anyone ever asks you, the inner cell mass is what turns into the amnion, the yolk sac, and the embryo. If I were you, I would circle all those three words and I would say to myself, well, the inner cell mass pretty much becomes everything, doesn't it? The other part of the blastocyst, shown with a purple star, is called the trophoblast. The trophoblast becomes the chorion. That's very important. That is what turns into the main embryonic part of the placenta. So that's the main baby's part of the placenta. I have another visual to help you remember this if you're a visual type person, and I kept it color-coded with the same colors. With a green star, I have all the structures labeled that come from the inner cell mass, which include the yolk sac, the embryo, and the amnion. With a purple star, I have all the structures that develop from the trophoblast, which include the chorion that I'm tracing now. And again, that becomes the main baby's part of the placenta. I threw this picture in here because I thought it was just an absolutely amazing photograph. This is a photograph of a 10-week-old fetus. And I don't know about you, but to me, that surely looks like a baby. So why are we learning this stuff? What's the point? This slide sort of puts a lot of stuff together, and I want to discuss something clinically relevant with you that ties together some of what we just discussed and some things we'll discuss very shortly. So here we go. We're going to learn that once a month, about in the middle of a woman's cycle, she undergoes ovulation in response, of course, to hormonal control. After ovulation, out comes, of course, you know, a secondary oocyte. If fertilization is to occur, usually occurs within a day or so after ovulation, and fertilization occurs in the middle of the fallopian tube. It becomes a structure, you know, called a diploid zygote. It sort of tumbles through the fallopian tube. After about 4 days in the tube, it forms that solid mound of cells called a morula. The morula tumbles into the uterine cavity. And about day 5, you recall, it forms a structure called a blastocyst. About day 6, that blastocyst implants in the uterine cavity wall. The successful implantation of a blastocyst, by the way, is called conception. So what, you might be saying to yourself? Well, I want to discuss briefly infertility using this slide. There are many women and men who cannot have a baby, and they go to the doctor for various fertility treatments. I know these may be controversial, but that's not the point of this course. That's another course. One of the potential treatments for infertility is in vitro fertilization, or in layman's terms, a test tube baby. Again, I know that's controversial. Not going to go there in this course. I have my own feelings about that, but I want to discuss it nonetheless. So what is a test tube baby, and how do they make in vitro fertilization happen? Well, for years, doctors actually debated what to do. I mean, you put the sperm and the egg cell together in a petri dish, so to speak, and you watch it, and doctors have always wondered, well, what do I take out of the petri dish? When do I take it out? Where do I put it when it's done or whatever? And believe it or not, it took doctors decades to come to a decision of what to do. And the final decision they came to, which was not too long ago, by the way, was they decided to take a day 5 or day 6 blastocyst out of the petri dish and implant it into the uterus. Well, yeah, of course. I mean, that's the way Mother Nature does it. So that's what you do. You take a day 5 or day 6 blastocyst out of the petri dish and you put it into the uterus where it belongs. So you just duplicate what Mother Nature intended. But believe me, for years they weren't sure what to take out or where to put it. You know, do you take out the zygote? Do you take out the morula? Do you put it in the tube? Do you put it somewhere else? No, you take out a day 5 or 6 blastocyst and you put it into the uterus just like this slide shows. Let's go ahead and discuss the next organ, the fallopian tubes, also called the uterine tubes. These are narrow tubes that extend from near the ovary to the uterus. Yes, it contains smooth muscle and cilia with a star. Let's stop right here and discuss a couple of key things. Number one, the uterine tube extends from near the ovary to the uterus. In other words, is the uterine tube slapped right on the ovary like a shop vac suctioned onto a bowling ball? No, it just barely touches the ovary. What about the smooth muscle? What's smooth muscle for? In general, in the human body, what's muscle for? To move things. And here, yes, the smooth muscle is going to help that fertilized egg head to the right direction, which, of course, is into the uterus. Cilia, you know what cilia do. They beat, they move. So they also have a role in pushing that fertilized egg in the right direction, hopefully to be implanted in the uterine, in the uterus. What are the basic parts of the fallopian tubes? Well, we have these finger-like structures called fimbria. They also move. Again, I think of the fimbria like little fingers, and they sweep the secondary oocyte that we may have just ovulated, and they sweep it, notice, from the pelvic cavity and into the fallopian tube. Remember, that fallopian tube is not suctioned right on that ovary like a shop vac on a bowling ball. So there's a little space in the pelvic cavity that the secondary oocyte has to get across before it makes it into the tube. Let's stop right there, because that leads to something very unusual, but it's possible. It is possible that the sperm fertilizes the egg in the pelvic cavity. There are actually cases in the literature reported where the fertilized egg implants somewhere in the woman's abdominal pelvic cavity. I did an internet search and I even found a report of an abdominal pregnancy many, many, many years ago that actually reportedly on the internet came to full term. Now, that's hard to believe. It's on the internet. This did seem to be from a reliable source. Now, look, nobody in their right mind in today's day and age would ever let an abdominal pregnancy go along, because that could kill both the mother and the baby. Of course, that's the most likely outcome. But it's amazing to think that it could even happen. It can happen. You could do an internet search on that. And this is the reason why on this slide. The next part of the tube is called the infundibulum. It's the funnel-shaped part of the tube near the ovary. And I kind of like this setup. The fingers sweep the egg cell into the infundibulum or into the funnel. Next part of the tube is the central, widest, longest region of the tube. It's called the ampulla, and you should absolutely know that the ampulla is the usual site of fertilization. The last part of the tube is where the tube hooks right up to the uterus, and it's called the isthmus. On this slide, while you're making some notes, I want to discuss some other disorders you may see. Many of you may have heard of something called PID, or pelvic inflammatory disease. Usually this is the result of a sexually transmitted disease such as gonorrhea, and those STDs can cause inflammation of the tube and scarring of the tube during the course of infection. That is one of the biggest causes of infertility. As a matter of fact, when I went to school decades ago, when someone came to us with infertility, the first thing we did is we just assumed they had an undiagnosed or an undertreated STD, and we gave them all antibiotics. And sometimes that enabled the woman to get pregnant. These days, there's a lot of fancy tests they do to be more specific to determine why a woman may be infertile. But again, in the old days, we just assumed they had an infection of the tubes. We gave them antibiotics, told them to come back. And a lot of times, that was the answer to their infertility problems. Also want to talk to you about something else fascinating. Check this out. And if this doesn't excite you, nothing will. Let's assume in a woman on this drawing, she lost her right ovary to some disease. Let's say it's gone. And let's say the woman lost her left fallopian tube to some disease. And let's just say it's gone. So that she's left with just a right fallopian tube and a left ovary. Can the woman still get pregnant? And the answer is yes. Because what happens? Something fascinating called tubal transmigration. In other words, the fallopian tube, which has smooth muscle, you know, it wanders across the woman's body and it finds the other ovary on the opposite side of the body. It actually happens. It's amazing. It's due in part to one of our old friends called chemotaxis. In other words, chemicals sort of attract that fallopian tube and cause it to swing over to the other side. And that is just amazing to me. Here's a picture showing the cilia in a woman's fallopian tubes. And what does smoking do to cilia? It paralyzes them so that what? Your female patients that smoke, they have a much higher chance of something terrible happening called an ectopic or a tubal pregnancy. Because the fertilized egg sometimes gets stuck in the fallopian tube because the cilia don't move it like they should. So if a baby tries to develop in the fallopian tube, again, that is potentially deadly to both the baby and the mother. They present to the emergency room, often with severe abdominal pain, and that leads to immediate surgery in the operating room to save the life of the woman. So this is another reason for your female patients not to smoke. We'll move on now to the uterus. Layman's terms for this, it's called the womb, but we'll all call this the uterus now. I'll outline it. It's described as being a pear shape in a woman. This is the site of implantation of the fertilized ovum. It's also the site of development of the fetus. It's the source of labor pains. It's also the source of menstrual flow. It is divided into four basic parts. This rounded bulbous part at the top called the fundus. Kind of looks like the fundus of the stomach, doesn't it? Then the main meat of this organ and almost every other organ in anatomy we call the body. The narrow piece down here we're going to call the isthmus. Sorry about that pronunciation. And then the cone-shaped piece at the bottom you probably all know is called the cervix. Some rocket scientist gave a name to the cavity inside the uterus. You got it. It's called the uterine cavity. Some genius gave a name to the canal inside the cervix, and they called that the cervical canal. One more important piece I want to throw at you here. This small external opening to the cervix that opens into the vagina is called the external os. Now, the reason I want you to know that is because many of you will be involved in a procedure called a pap smear. A pap smear is a scraping of epithelial cells off the cervix to look for cervical cancer. The earlier we detect it and treat it, the better off everyone is. And where they scrape the cells from is right around the external os. So if you're helping on a pap smear and the doctor says, okay, help me scrape the external os, I hope you know now where you're supposed to do the scraping. I also want you on this slide to pay attention to the many ligaments that help keep the ovaries, fallopian tubes, and uterus in position. There are many of them. I only want you to know one for my course. It's the big one. It's the broad one called the broad ligaments that anchor the uterus to the sides of the pelvic cavity wall. And what I want you to know with a star on it is the woman's ureters run through the broad ligaments. What are the implications of that? Well, if you have to do a surgery, if you have to do a hysterectomy and remove a woman's uterus, yes, you have to cut and dissect the broad ligaments, but you must be very careful in your dissection. You do not want to nick the woman's ureter. If you do that, that patient will not like you forever, and neither will her attorney. If you think these ligaments are not important, I'll give you another example. With time, with gravity, with multiple pregnancies, with age, these ligaments weaken, and the uterus can actually drop. There's a name for it called prolapse. There are different degrees of uterine prolapse. That's where the uterus gets pushed through or drops through the woman's vagina, and it can actually get partially or sometimes even totally outside the woman's vaginal canal. There's different ways to treat uterine prolapse. It depends on the patient, the degree of prolapse, and things can range all the way up to surgery for the prolapse. But you, trust me, if you work in the geriatric unit, you will see elderly women where they have their uterus poking out of their vagina. This wonderful sagittal section through a cadaver once again demonstrates the position of the uterus. You must know the anatomical location in order from front to back. Here we have, of course, the pubic symphysis, then the urinary bladder, then the uterus, then the rectum. I spell a word, bladder, uterus, rectum, B-U-R. So from front to back, the word is BUR. If you prefer to go from back to front, it's R-U-B, which spells the word RUB. And again, that stands for rectum, uterus, and bladder. You also see on this slide, once again, when a woman's pregnant, the uterus presses on that urinary bladder and they feel like they have to go to the bathroom all the time. This is a drawing from your book. I was actually going to throw this out, but one year I gave my slides to my brother-in-law, who's an OBGYN doctor, and he gave this reproductive lecture a couple times in my classes, and he looked at my slides, and I told him I was going to throw this slide out, and he said, no, don't throw this slide out. This is actually the view we see when we do laparoscopic female surgery. This is what it looks like in a drawing. And it looks pretty complicated. Look at all those pieces and parts. Look at all those ligaments. And I just threw this in here for your amazement. But this is a surgeon's view of when they do laparoscopic female surgery. So that's the reason I left it in here. Let's talk about the layers of the uterus. This should be anatomy 101 for you guys. We've done this many times and the term should sound familiar. The outermost covering of the uterus is called the perimetrium. Peri means around, metrium means uterus. It is just another name for the serosa, which you know is just another name for the visceral peritoneum. Those are all synonyms. It's the shiny wrapping on top of the uterus. The next layer is the middle, big, thick layer of muscle called the myometrium. Myo, you know, means muscle. There are three thick layers of smooth muscle that are, of course, involved in labor and also pains from cramping. The innermost layer is the endometrium. Endo means inside. The endometrium is lined by simple columnar epithelium and divided into two layers. You know the root word for layers is stratum. Like if you ever took a course on geology or saw different layers of rock in a mountainside, that's just called strata, or certain societies are divided into layers. So if you're a sociology type, you know that that's called a stratum as well, or stratified. So stratum just means a layer. The layer that is the functional layer, the innermost layer that is shed during menstruation, is called the stratum functionalis. The layer at the base of that is called the stratum basalis, and it is the layer that's responsible for replacing the stratum functionalis on a monthly basis. This slide just shows some histological preparations of the layers we just discussed. This will help you maybe more in lab histology than it will in lecture, but it's nice to look at the different layers: endometrium, myometrium, perimetrium, and then off to your right, we blow up really big the inner stratum functionalis, which is lined by simple columnar epithelium, and then at the base, we have the stratum basalis. On this slide, we're going to discuss blood supply to the uterus. And like so many other organs in anatomy, if you don't understand the blood supply of an organ, you don't understand how it works. So I'm going to let you know the important vessels for this organ. The detail is, of course, we have an aorta. Off the aorta comes the internal iliac arteries. But what I want you to know is, the uterine arteries supply the uterus. Well, that's pretty simple for my pea brain. But there are two important branches that come off the uterine arteries that I want you to know. And they're blown up a little bit bigger here. First, I want you to know the straight arterioles go straight to the stratum basalis. So the straight arterioles go straight to the base. Then wiggling, spiraling upwards and inwards from those straight arterioles are arterioles called spiral arterioles, because they spiral. And they spiral up into the superficial stratum functionalis. Why do I want you to know that? Because we'll see when we study the female reproductive cycle in detail that it's constriction of those spiral arterioles due to hormonal changes that starts a woman's menstrual cycle. Hormones control everything. We're going to see that in a woman's cycle, there's a point in time where progesterone rapidly decreases. It just hits the toilet. And when progesterone bottoms out, another hormone we study called prostaglandins go through the roof. And it's that little cycle of those two hormones that both begin with a P, that PP cycle or that PP roller coaster, is going to result in kinking of those spiral arterioles. And if I kink those puppies off, what's going to happen? Well, no blood supply to the stratum functionalis, and if there's no blood, there's no live. So it dies and falls off. It sheds. So yes, this is an important slide. We'll talk a little bit about hysterectomy. Hysterectomy just means surgical removal of the uterus. Possible indications for surgery include endometriosis, excessive bleeding, fibroids, and cancer. I'll talk a little bit about a couple of those. Fibroids, by the way, are just benign, smooth muscle tumors of the uterus, of the myometrium. They can become quite large and uncomfortable. They're fascinating to look at images of on the internet if you care to Google that. Endometriosis, I do want to talk about that a little bit. It's a fascinating disease academically. Things that are fascinating to us academically are not fascinating to your patients at all. Please remember that. Endometriosis is not uncommon at all. Here's the theory about endometriosis. Little pieces of endometrium, they break off and they go backwards. They go backwards through the fallopian tube and then out into the abdominopelvic cavity. And they could seed just or land on just about any organ in the abdominopelvic cavity you could think of. They could land on the intestines. They could land on the ovaries. They could stay stuck in the fallopian tubes. I've seen it on the appendix. And the problem is, those pieces of endometrial tissue, they respond to the hormones of the reproductive cycle we're going to talk about. So they end up bleeding. And when they end up bleeding, they end up causing scarring and pain. So they could scar the fallopian tubes. They can scar the ovaries. This is a big cause of infertility in women. And the key is, if you diagnose it and treat it early, you guessed it, usually with hormones, you can help that woman to be fertile. So you've got to catch this early and treat it early. Some advanced cases are treated with surgery. There are different surgical options. You can do an internet search on. They're interesting as well. We'll next talk about the vagina. From an academic standpoint, it's just a boring fibromuscular tube that's lined by non-keratinized stratified squamous epithelium. Why stratified squamous, by the way? Remember, the design matches the mission. This is for protection. The vagina extends from the uterine cervix to the exterior of the body. It is a passageway potentially for sperm upwards, and it is a passageway downwards for menstrual flow and potentially childbirth. While we're on this slide, I want to talk about AIDS. Who has a higher chance of getting the HIV infection from heterosexual sex? A man from a woman or a woman from a man? And the answer is, a woman has a higher chance of getting AIDS from a man. Why? Two big reasons. If you ever seen the inside of a vagina, the vagina is very red. There's lots of blood vessels, which gives an entrance portal for HIV. But the big reason I want to talk about hooks into immunology. The vagina has a lot of cells called dendritic cells. Remember, dendritic cells are really a special kind of a macrophage. They grab on to things that they recognize and they hand it off to the helper T cell, which usually is a good thing because the helper T cell gets your whole immune system fired off and starts your body attacking any bad guys that it sees. But the problem with the AIDS virus is this. The HIV virus loves to eat helper T cells for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. So unfortunately here, the dendritic cells that are rich in the vagina, they give that virus right to the helper T cell, which it destroys. And the helper T cell is the whole linchpin to the organization of your immune system, and it lops off the head of the snake, so to speak. So this is a very unfortunate setup for a woman in this situation. Another great mid-sagittal section through a woman, showing you the location of the vagina sandwiched right in the middle. Once again, don't forget it. I'll show you another picture and give you another mnemonic so you'll never forget where that vagina is located. This leads us to the vulva. The vulva is just another name for the external female genitals. The five major parts we'll discuss are listed on this slide. We'll look at them one at a time in this order. Let's start with the mons pubis. So here is a figure from your textbook, and those of you going into health care, primary care, or OBGYN, this is a view you will be faced with. many times, and you must know the anatomy very well. The mons pubis is just this mound of adipose tissue and skin and hair that's over the pubic symphysis. It just has a little cushioning effect. If you like your Greek root words, mons means a mountain, by the way. So it's a little mound of fat and skin and hair. Next, we have two folds of skin, the outer labia majora and then the inner labia minora. What's important here is the labia minora, the inner skin folds, surround a space called the vestibule. How many times have you seen the word vestibule in anatomy? It just means a space. And you must know what is in the vestibule in a woman. There are some very important openings in the vestibule. Number one, this opening here is the woman's external urethral orifice. Next in the vestibule, we have the opening called the vaginal orifice. Finally, there are numerous openings of ducts, of glands that are for lubrication, that also are in a woman's vestibule. The important clinical thing I want to tell you on this slide is, while this on this diagram maybe looks easy to you, if you're going to be a nurse or a doctor, one of the things you're going to have to do is do or place a catheter, a Foley catheter. A catheter is placed into a woman's urethra, and you insert it up into the bladder. You place a Foley catheter in women for various reasons. You'll see it placed during surgery very commonly, for example, and you want to make sure you put it in the right opening. On this slide, it looks real easy, but I'm telling you, in real life, it's not so clear cut. And it's not unusual, especially on your first couple of tries, you might put it in the wrong opening, and that's embarrassing for both you and the patient. So I have a little mnemonic device for you to remember the proper openings. From anterior to posterior, we have three openings in a woman. We have the urethra, the vagina, and the anus. And that spells UVA. I guess if you're a University of Virginia fan, that helps you. But in any case, the point is UVA is my mnemonic. If you see three holes in order from anterior to posterior and you're putting in a catheter, pick the one on the top, which is really anterior in anatomical position. Last on this slide, we have a small mass of erectile tissue called the clitoris. It's located at the junction of the folds of the labia minora. And if you're interested, the clitoris is analogous to the gland's penis in a male, embryologically. On this slide, we'll discuss a region of the body called the perineum. Here we're looking at an inferior view between the thighs. Somebody decided to name this area. It's an area in both sexes, both men and women have this area. It's called the perineum. The perineum is a diamond-shaped area between the thighs in both men and women. You should know what makes up this diamond. In the front is the pubic symphysis. The back point of the diamond is your old friend the coccyx. And then the lateral borders of the diamond are the ischial tuberosities. Furthermore, somebody decided for our studying pleasure to divide this diamond into two triangles. The anterior diamond is called the urogenital triangle because it contains the external genitals. And the triangle in the back is called the anal triangle because it contains the anus. Now, why am I focusing on this slide? Because you will see many people who have infections down here. You can imagine there's lots of bacteria in this area. It's not uncommon to see a patient with a perineal abscess. Maybe you're the next nurse on the shift and the chart note says, please change the dressings in the perineal abscess 3 times per shift or something like that. Well, if you didn't know where the perineum was, you wouldn't know where to be changing the dressings. Also on this slide, I want to discuss something called an episiotomy. What's an episiotomy? Well, during childbirth, of course, the baby comes out the vaginal canal, and sometimes tearing occurs, and you don't want uncontrolled tearing during childbirth. Sometimes what happens is a tear occurs from the vagina to the anus, and then you're left with a communication, a channel, something called a fistula between the vagina and the anus, and you don't want a communication between the anus with all its bacteria and a woman's vagina. It can cause long-term problems, lead to long-term corrective surgery, which is very difficult. So what doctors will often do during delivery is they'll make an incision with their sharp blade under controlled circumstances that lets the baby ease out nicely, and then they can suture it up very nicely as well. So another reason to know this important anatomy. The last part of the woman's body that we're going to discuss are the breasts. The breasts are both part of the integumentary system as well as the reproductive system. Breasts, you should know, are located anterior to the pectoralis major muscle. If you're involved in any kind of breast surgery, whether it's reconstructive surgery or breast implants, you must know that the breasts are anterior to the pec major muscle. Most of the breast is actually made of fat tissue or adipose tissue. If anybody asks you what makes up most of a woman's breast, you will say this yellow adipose tissue. Some women have a lot of it. In some women, it causes problems with posture or backaches. And some women actually go to surgery for breast reduction. And if you ever see one of those surgeries, in the dish is a bunch of yellow fat. It looks like chicken fat. There are risks to any surgery. There are numerous risks, including breast reduction surgery. One of the risks that's interesting academically that you must know about is after surgery, there's scar tissue because we really can't do totally scarless surgery. The problem is, on a mammogram, sometimes scar tissue can imitate or mimic cancer. So after breast reduction surgery, it's a little bit harder for the doctor sometimes to tell scar tissue from breast cancer. That's an important thing to discuss with your patients who are undergoing or contemplating undergoing the surgery. Now, within each breast is a modified sweat gland called a mammary gland. Yes, it's a sweat gland. So if you're thinking about it like I am, breast milk is actually breast sweat. Inside the mammary gland, we see these lobular structures, and yep, they're called lobules. Histologically, you'll study in lab, inside the lobules are small little pockets or sockets for milk. They are called alveoli. Alveoli in anatomy just means a pocket or a socket for something. You saw them in the lungs, they're pockets or sockets for air. You saw them in the jawbones, they're pockets or sockets for teeth. What happens in the alveoli? We have the synthesis, secretion, and ejection of milk, and that process, you must know, is called lactation. That milk travels through a series of ducts that some genius called the lactiferous ducts. I love that name. Lact means milk. Fer means to carry. So the lactiferous ducts are just the milk-carrying ducts. And notice where those ducts open. They open at the nipple. Very important to know, especially if you're a lactation nurse. Around the nipple is this pigmented area called the areola, and one of the mistakes that first-time mothers often have is when they're trying to get their babies to suckle is they have the baby suckle too far off to the side on the areola. And as a lactation nurse, you will teach the mother to have the baby suckle on the nipple, of course, because that's where the milk ducts open. Last on this slide, within the breast are these connective tissue white ligaments. They're called Cooper's ligaments. And with time and age and gravity and so forth, they become loose and the breasts start to droop with age. There's really a name for it. I'm not making it up. It's called Cooper's droop. And that's why somebody invented sports bras, to try to decrease the sagging with age, especially in athletes where there's a lot of tension placed on these ligaments. We're going to wrap up this unit with a ton of physiology. This is the hardest part for most people of this unit. We're going to discuss in great detail the female reproductive cycle. What does that mean? You should write this down. It means everything that happens in a woman's body during the monthly cycle, including everything that happens in her ovaries, called the ovarian cycle, everything that happens in her uterus, called the uterine or the menstrual cycle, which we will study, includes in order a menstrual phase, followed by preovulatory phase, followed by ovulation, and followed by the postovulatory phase. And you should write down here, I left a blank, the female reproductive cycle also includes all the hormonal changes that take place during the monthly cycle. So let's take a look at these things in some great detail. And I love to use this figure. So what's the setup here? At the top, of course, we have the all-controlling hypothalamus and anterior pituitary gland with all their hormones. I will actually discuss that last. First, I want to discuss the ovarian cycle, and it's easy. We already did it. If I ask you the ovarian cycle in order, you already know the terms. We start with primordial follicles, followed by primary follicles, then a secondary follicle. Next comes the mature or graafian follicle. After ovulation, we're left with something called a corpus luteum. And then if there's no pregnancy, that withers on the vine and dies after about 2 weeks and forms a small white scar called a corpus albicans. Likewise, the uterine or menstrual cycle is very easy. Already briefly mentioned the four phases. By definition, not my definition because I would have done it a different way. By definition, the menstrual cycle starts with the menstrual phase, followed by the preovulatory phase, followed by ovulation, and then the last phase is the postovulatory phase. Notice the big picture. What's happening during the phases of the uterine cycle after menstruation? Well, what's happening is the stratum functionalis is just getting more and more and more pumped up and fluffed up like a fluffy bed of grass, because the whole point is, again, to make a baby. We're getting ready for a baby. So we're getting that uterine tissue all fluffed up and ready and nice, prepared for the baby. Here comes the big deal with triple stars down here at the bottom of my slide. All of this needs to be explained and tied together with the hormones. Remember, hormones control everything. So here's how I do it using this graph down below. First comes FSH. First with an F, FSH with an F. First comes FSH, shown here in blue, from the anterior pituitary gland. That's follicle-stimulating hormone, and that stimulates the follicles to mature into bigger and bigger ones. Finally, one forms called the mature follicle. Usually there's only one mature dominant follicle during the woman's cycle. And that mature follicle says, hey, I want to be the one to pop. I want to be the one to ovulate. I want to kick all you other guys off to the side. So next what happens is the mature follicle starts to put out more and more and more estrogens. It makes an estrogen spike close to the middle of the cycle. It sends that big estrogen signal up to the pituitary gland and says, hey, I'm the Mac Daddy follicle. I want to ovulate. I'm sending you a high dose of estrogen. That's your signal. And the anterior pituitary, in response, it lets down LH. And you have this big yellow mid-cycle LH surge. LH causes ovulation of the secondary oocyte and formation of our big puffed up, pumped up bag of progesterone producing cells called the corpus luteum, which produces the next hormone in this graph shown in red called progesterone. Progesterone goes through the roof. Why? Progesterone prepares the way for the baby. It pumps up the uterus tissue. It also pumps up the breast tissue. Progesterone prepares the way for the baby. But what if there's no baby? If there's no baby, the corpus luteum dies. If the corpus luteum dies, what happens to progesterone? It hits the floor. It just totally bottoms out to next to nothing. And then what your book forgot to put in here that you need to draw is when progesterone hits the floor, another hormone, a hormone made by every cell in the human body except red blood cells, goes through the roof. I want you to draw a big red peak here of a hormone, our old friend called prostaglandins. Prostaglandins go through the roof. And when prostaglandins go through the roof, that causes kinking of the spiral arterioles, that causes bloating, it causes inflammation, it causes pain, it causes cramps, it leads to Motrin, Nuprin, Pamprin, Aleve, all that stuff. And when it kinks those arterioles, the stratum functionalis dies and it sheds off in that process we know called menstruation. So this is one big hormonal symphony, isn't it? Or maybe it's really more like a heavy metal concert. But look, you get the idea. You, to understand what's happening in a woman's body during the month, you must know these hormonal changes. Women can feel these things. I know this might seem complicated to some of you. And some of you are saying to yourself, man, I need some help with this. No, you don't need some help with this. You need FELP. That's right. I gave you a mnemonic. It's F-E-L-P-P. That stands for FSH, estrogen, LH, progesterone, and prostaglandins. And hopefully that will FELP you on the test. There's really nothing new on this slide, just a magnified view showing you up top. We have the hypothalamic pituitary axis of control. It's showing you the mature, the one and only dominant follicle making really high levels of estrogen, which is letting the pituitary gland know it wants to ovulate. The anterior pituitary gland lets out its huge, big mid-cycle LH surge, which makes the mature follicle swell up and pop like a water balloon and outbursts the secondary oocyte. So a nice magnified view of ovulation, but nothing really new on this picture. On this picture, I did want to discuss a condition you may have heard of or may have run into called polycystic ovary syndrome, or PCO. So for those of you who don't think the stuff we're doing here is significant, let me go ahead and give you an example. The hormones we discussed here sometimes don't happen right in a woman, and they end up having trouble getting pregnant. And what happens is their hormone balance goes out of whack. If you measure their hormone levels, their LH will be way too high. Their FSH will be way too low. They'll be out of balance, so they won't ovulate properly, and they develop cystic-looking ovaries. Furthermore, those women put out too many androgens, which you can measure in their blood, and they tend to grow hair as well. The women often tend to be overweight. You should diagnose these women early by their physical appearance and their complaints and their blood test that you'll do. Because if you treat them early, you got it with hormones, you can help them with this condition and maybe help them to have a baby. Furthermore, these women are likely to develop type 2 diabetes. You can also catch that early and treat them with the type 2 anti-diabetic drugs and further help that patient. I have an animation in here from your textbook. If you want to roll through the details, it's a good slide. Again, I hope these links are working for you. If they ever break down, somebody please email me. As you know, links tend to do that. Our next slide is absolutely key. You must know the important ovarian hormones made, and you must know their functions. Some of this will be review, but there's a lot of new goodies on here that you must know. If you want to understand what's happening in a woman's body, if you want to be able to help them, you must understand this. You'll be able to figure out so much of what's going on in your female patients if you know this slide by heart. So let's start at the top. The anterior pituitary gland makes FSH. FSH is follicle-stimulating hormone. Follicle-stimulating hormone stimulates follicles to grow. And furthermore, FSH stimulates those follicles to produce estrogens. It would serve you well to think of, in a woman, that FSH equals estrogen. And what do estrogens do for a woman? They promote the development and maintenance of the female reproductive structures and of the female secondary sexual characteristics, including breast development, including distribution of fat, which is different in a woman than a man, usually broader hips, the voice, of course, different, not that deep voice like a man has, hair distribution, and so forth. Look what else estrogens do for a woman. They increase protein anabolism or protein synthesis in a woman. You should write down including in bones. Also, estrogens, they lower a woman's blood cholesterol. I want to give you two great clinical correlations to show you the importance of estrogens in a woman. What happens after menopause in a woman? What happens to her ovaries? They go down, right, in function. What happens to levels of estrogen production after menopause, therefore, in a woman? Goes down the chute as well. So what happens in a woman that you must know for my course and for life? Well, not as much protein buildup, including not as much protein synthesis in bones. So after menopause, women tend to get bad bones. You heard that. They get osteoporosis after menopause. And what about blood cholesterol? Well, this ties into heart attack risk. Before menopause, women have a less chance of heart attack than men. But after menopause, they lose the protective effect of estrogens as far as on the cholesterol levels, and their cholesterol levels tend to drift upwards, and their heart attack risk after time eventually starts to equal the heart attack risk of a man. So very important to know this. Let's look on the other side of this diagram. The anterior pituitary gland also releases LH. LH stimulates ovulation mid-cycle, which leads to development of the all-important structure, the corpus luteum, which you know is a pumped-up bag of hormones, mostly progesterone. Look at all the hormones made by the corpus luteum. Yes, estrogens, progesterone, relaxin, and inhibin, but the main one with double stars around it is progesterone. Progesterone prepares the way for the baby. It works with estrogens, by the way, to prepare the uterus, gets it all fluffed up for the baby, prepares the mammary glands, really sort of primes the pump, so to speak, to let the mammary glands be able to secrete milk for the baby. So progesterone prepares the way for the baby. Look at these other cute hormones on this slide. A hormone called relaxin. Guess what relaxin's going to do? It's going to relax something. It relaxes the pubic symphysis and dilates, relaxes the cervix during childbirth, so it lets the baby come out easier. That's a pretty cool hormone to have. And then there's another one called inhibin. We've heard of inhibin before. Inhibin's going to do exactly what it says it's going to do. It's going to inhibit something. I mean, think about this. Look how smart the body is. We just ovulated, right? We may be having a baby. You want to ovulate again? You want to ovulate 3 more, 4 more, 5 more, 6 more times? Have 6 more babies at one time? I'm guessing most people saying probably not. So the body's smart. After ovulation, the corpus luteum sends this inhibitory signal back up here to the pituitary gland and says, calm down. Let's slow down production of FSH. Let's slow down production of LH. And let's just calm down right now because there might already be a baby on the way. Our final slide deals with the importance of the corpus luteum, which I hope you know by now is critical. So how does the corpus luteum know whether to stay or whether to go? That reminds me of an old song, should I stay or should I go now? How does the corpus luteum know? Well, it's all going to boil down to hormones, isn't it? Because hormones combined with your nervous system control everything. If pregnancy occurs, if there's a baby, there is a placenta, right? And the baby's part of the placenta makes a hormone. The hormone's called HCG. And HCG goes to the corpus luteum and says, hey, there's a baby. You need to stick around because I need that big bag of hormones that you make. As a matter of fact, I mean, how do you tell if someone's pregnant? I mean, how do I know if I'm pregnant? I go to the doctor or I go to Walmart or wherever and I buy, you know, the stick and you urinate on the stick and it turns blue or pink or plus or minus. Or you go to the doctor, you get a blood test. What are they looking for? They're looking for a hormone. That's what they're detecting. They're detecting HCG, which the embryo starts to produce at about 8 days, roughly. I have a picture here. You probably already noticed that. At the bottom of the slide is a real gross anatomy picture of a placenta. Just so it turns out that the placenta produces buckets of progesterone and estrogen as well. Really kicks in a ton of progesterone and estrogen. It ends up making way more than the corpus luteum can make, actually. Starts really kicking in at about 3 months. Women often notice this. I mean, when hormones are going up and down, you could tell. As a matter of fact, you've all heard of morning sickness. And morning sickness is caused by these huge surges in progesterone that are mostly produced by the placenta. Fascinating unit of the course. I hope you understand the importance of what you're learning and, once again, the importance of hormones in the human body.